To the Simple Actions group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Morgan and I'm an alcoholic. Hello, everybody. Just some housekeeping. We will be recording and publishing the audio only portion of this meeting. You can sign up for email or listen to previously recorded meetings at our website, simpleactions.net. For those who care to join us, let's open the meeting with the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The Simple Actions group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are right through those doors. Newcomers, is there anyone in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would like to welcome you. On Zoom, you can raise your hand and somebody in the Zoom room will chat with you. All right. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism by taking AA Simple Actions. This is the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open Big Book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. And this evening, we are discussing step 4, part 2, fear and sex. Please welcome our panel. We got Amy and Larry. I'm going to read the first paragraph on page 67, then the panel will each share for a few minutes on the reading. Step 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. First reading on 67. Notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and the wife. The short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. Got to figure out which one of y'all wants to go first.
Okay. Hey, Larry Alcoholic.
Hey, Larry.
Oh yeah, get the important stuff out of the way. My sobriety date is January 31st, 2017. I have a home group. It's the Candlelight Meeting. We meet Fridays at 8 p.m. on 1301 Cali at First Lutheran Church. I do not have a service position in that home group any longer, but I do have a service position at a state level. And I also I have a sponsor. I talk to him regularly, and I also sponsor other people. I say that just to tell you that I'm fully invested in Alcoholics Anonymous. I try to do as much as I can to be of service in various ways, whether it be with a home group or service through, like I said, I help out with the website at the state level. So I swear we don't plan it this way. We spoke together last time. We're also in the same home group. I won't spoil Amy's introductions. But step 4, this fear part. This, you know, at this point, I'll talk about the first time that I did an inventory with my first sponsor. At this point, I had done the resentment stuff. The way we did our inventory, we do it relatively quickly. The paragraph that this whole part starts off on about, and I'm sure you guys probably talked about it last week. You know, I've now made this decision, And the evidence that I've made that decision is now I'm going through this inventory, and it uses words like vigorous. It says the decision that I make has no permanent effect unless followed by what I'm doing now. So at this point, I've already written down these columns. And now I'm looking at this fear inventory. And my fears, years even before I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, I spent a lot of time in therapy for an anxiety disorder, panic disorder, you name it, full of fears. I am riddled with fear. So I was like, yeah, I can do this. It should be pretty simple. And some of it were, some of the things that I wrote down were your run of the mill fears, fear of dying, fear of people, fear of speaking in front of people. But then some of them based off, I mean, the way this thing is written, a lot of my fears were directly related to some of the things that I had written down as resentment. So I had a fear of being alone. And this is the part in when I'm writing the inventory down that I start to see things that are contradictions of each other. I have a fear of being alone, yet I have a bad habit of pushing people away. I had a fear of dying, yet I'm slowly killing myself through drugs and alcohol. These things start to pop up as I'm writing these things down. In the paragraph we read, I'm getting older, so I am now at the age where I now need reading glasses, or I have to take my glasses off, which is new for me. It's a fear, getting old. That was there too. A lot of it was because self-reliance. Let's see, where's it at? Didn't we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classified as stealing because it causes more trouble. Often everything that I was fearful of, like I was just saying, all these contradictions, a lot of them are of my own doing. I had a fear that one of my biggest fears was that my kids would be, my father died, I'm all over the place. My father died in 2005. And that was one of like the darkest times for me. I got really, my drug and alcohol use got really, really bad. And I was not present for my family. I made it really all about me. My brother had to step up and do all the funeral arrangements and all that stuff. And it was all about Larry. Everybody was very concerned about me because I just could not function. And I just drowned everything out into drugs and alcohol. And I had this big fear when I first wrote the fear inventory that my children would go through what I went through, that they would not be able to survive, and that they would go through all this pain when I die. I'm not even dead yet. Yet at the same time, I'm literally killing myself. I had even tried to commit suicide several times, but I have this fear. When I am deep into my insanity of drinking, all those fears kind of, alcohol for me in many ways, not really got rid of those fears, but I didn't care about them. And at this point in recovery, I'm trying to stay sober. I'm trying to figure out how to stay stopped. And all of these things are just very difficult for me to deal with. And typically what I do is when these things get overwhelming, I go back to drinking. So at this point in the inventory, I'm writing all these fears down, and all these things start really hitting me upside of my head. The stuff about my children, the stuff about my wife, all those things also came up on my resentment inventory, the four columns. I had a resentment towards my wife, which I guess we're going to have to get into later as we talk about sex. I guess we're going to talk about sex at this. But I came into Alcoholics Anonymous to try to save my marriage, to save my family. I'm one of those guys, right? I do think it's admirable for people who do that. I know they say whatever you put in front of your recovery, you'll lose. I don't know. This is debatable for me. I actually did come in to try to save my life and try to better myself for my family. Did I end up sticking around for that? Not really. I had to kind of do it for myself. But at this point in writing my inventory, this fear stuff, I started to piece these pieces together. That a lot of the things that I was afraid of, I was directly causing in my life. I've been relying on myself for too long. And I know we're probably going to read the next paragraph, which talks about self-reliance. So I'll stop it at that point. Thanks for letting me share.
Thanks for sharing. I'm Amy. I'm an alcoholic. And like Larry said, we have the same home group. So he already said where to find us. My sobriety date is September 5th of 2016. And I have a sponsor, and I also do not have a position in our home group, a service position in our home group. But I'm active in Alcoholics Anonymous in doing other things. I guess to jump right in, about fear. So I can remember in my very early first time of getting sober and first time of putting any effort into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember feeling empty, like I just felt nothing for the first time, which caused so much anxiety because I have all these really, really, really big, big feelings and I have absolutely no fucking idea what to do with them. I have no idea how to feel feelings. They're awful. I still have a problem with feelings today. I can remember my very first sponsor actually taught me how to sit alone, sit with myself. I am afraid of loneliness. I am afraid to be alone. I am afraid to leave my child behind. I am also a person who has attempted suicide. Alcohol, for me, made everything cloudy. Perfect. Drugs and alcohol, for me, took the uncomfortable, the thinking, the feeling, made all of that stuff go away. And that was fine. That worked very well for me for over 15 years. And so when it comes time to write down the things that I am afraid of, I'm also a person who's very therapized. I was in therapy for a long, long time, but I never told a therapist. I told a therapist the truth, the whole truth, at the age of 29, because I did not want to die. And I, for some reason, knew that I needed to just spill all of my guts. And I did. And I think I started my very first therapy appointment was probably when I was like 9 or 10 years old. So, you know, 20 years of not telling the truth to anybody about anything did me absolutely no good. So I start to write this fear inventory, and, you know, and I am afraid to be abandoned. My very first memory in life is not having my dad around, is being abandoned. What is wrong with me? Why wasn't I good enough? Didn't have anything to do with that. I know that as an adult, that did not have anything to do with me, but I didn't know that like as a child and as a teenager, it didn't really make any difference. And really as an adult, it kind of doesn't make a difference as to what people, you know, say. The truth of the matter is that it happened and it sucks and it sits with you, sits with me. And I like to pour booze on top of those kinds of feelings because it just melts them all away. And so that's how I handle fear for a good portion of my life. And then the effects produced by alcohol, yes, I like that very, very much. But I had to realize that what alcohol was doing to my life was bigger than that. And I couldn't do that without looking at like the fear inventory, without taking the moral inventory. And so, you know, it says it was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. I did everything because of fear. I acted out in every part of my life because I was afraid. I was afraid you were going to go away. I was afraid I was going to lose a job. I was afraid that you weren't going to like me. I did everything out of fear because I want to try to control everything, because I like for everything to be very, very close by, because that makes me feel comfortable. And I like the part where it says it ought to be classed with stealing, because really that's what I did. Like I stole, you know, opportunities from other people, really, you know, opportunities for, you know, other people to, I don't know, that makes, well, master manipulator, I guess it's manipulative. Yeah, definitely manipulative. But like you steal time from people being a train wreck and a tornado. And I was definitely that because of fear. So yeah, I think that's all I got for now.
Thank you both. All right, the next reading is going to be on page 68. Perhaps there is a better way. We think so. For we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role he assigned, just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. At once, we commenced to outgrow fear. Very.
So it's funny, this paragraph, because I actually used to think, when I was going to AA, I wasn't doing Alcoholics Anonymous, but I was attending a lot of meetings. I thought that you all were pretty weak because you needed God. You talked about God a lot. And this paragraph directly addresses that, is that some people will laugh at those who think spirit. I remember thinking that you all need this as a crutch. All I need to do is figure out my life a little better, and then I'll stop drinking. I don't need to do the whole spirituality thing. So it's funny, I read this paragraph and I remember reading it with my sponsor the first time, and I felt like it was speaking directly at me. And the way I look at it, the way I read it, is that having faith that things are going to turn out exactly the way they're supposed to turn out requires some source, a little bit of strength. For me, and this is what I wanted to talk about before, is that a lot of my fears that I were writing down directly boiled down to my lack of being able to control certain situations. My fear that things were not going to turn out the way I wanted them to turn out. The first thing I wrote down on my fear inventory was death. That was the number one thing. I used to sit up at night. I don't know. I've only met a few other people who do this. I don't do it as much, but I still do on occasion. I'll think about death, and to the point where I get goosebumps and I get so fearful, and I have to distract myself and think about something else, because the finality of it, the ambiguity about it, I don't know what's really going to happen. I start going down this rabbit hole about my children, and that's the ultimate lack of control for me. Here is something that is inevitable in my life that I cannot avoid. It is going to happen. That's a fact. I have no say so. Well, I might have a say so when it happens, but depending on, you know, what I talked about earlier. But in general, I don't know. And those are the things that would keep me up at night. And I had this as the number one thing on my inventory. And really, a lot of the things there were directly related to this notion that Larry has an idea of the way things should turn out, and I'm full of fear that they will not happen that way. Bill spends a lot of time, a couple pages back, talking about self-centeredness. I think he writes it like 13, 14 times, self. And it talks about I don't want to quote. I'm trying to not be a quoting machine, but I saw a paraphrase that me trying to run my life cannot be a sin. Me purely relying on self-will over and over again. And the way I read it is that Bill is just explaining the human condition, because he doesn't even mention alcoholics. He says any life run on self-will. And a lot of my fear is based off what it said here in this an earlier paragraph about this notion of self-reliance. I'm relying on me and my own faculties. And if I can just manipulate the situation just right, then maybe it'll turn out the way I want it to turn out. And my fear is that that's not going to happen. I'm not going to be able to manipulate the situation correctly. I'm not going to be able to manage the chessboard just the way I need it to manage. And what happens when I'm full of fear, my knee-jerk reaction is to control. And all this stuff is starting to come out on my inventory, is that what I do is I try to control people, places, and things and situations. I have a fear that my wife is going to leave me, so I start to do things to try to control that situation. I have a fear that I'm going to lose my job, so I start to try to control my job and try to control people around me. Maybe even start to do things a little underhanded so I can make sure I don't lose my job. right? And all these things start to pop up and I'm relying on self-will and what these steps teach me. And the biggest gift that I get from the 12 steps as a whole, and it's a, to me, for a guy like me, it's a miracle, is that I can be okay when life is not okay. Because what I do when, like, what I've done in the past when life is not okay is that I try to fix it. I try to fix that situation, fix that person. I try to manipulate my way to make it better, because I think I was just born with this idea that I don't, I can't be uncomfortable. I can't be in pain. So I got to make it where everything is ease and comfort, constant pursuit of ease and comfort. I don't know how to sit into my pain. I don't know how to lean into it, because I have this fear that it's going to make me do something that I don't want to do. And today I can lean into pain. I can, we were talking before the meeting, like, you know, if after a few years in recovery, I started to wonder, is this it? You know, where's all the spiritual experiences that were coming one after another when I'm taking the steps and I'm making amends and it's like, yeah, I'm starting to feel this and I'm sponsoring people. And some of that starts to be like fading away. And it's like, this is it. Recovery for me today is just being a normal human, living my day-to-day life. I don't have to pursue these great earth-shattering, profound ordeals where it's just this upheaval of feelings. And, you know, and because in many ways, that's the same thing that I used to do. But it all started with this inventory and the ability to sort of accept. It sounds so cliche, and it's one of those things that, you know, I used to laugh at. You know, people talk about page 417 and acceptance being the key and all that stuff. But really, it's kind of the way it is for me today. It sounds kind of silly to hear myself say it, but I have a sponsee, and I often catch myself saying it over and over and over again. This is exactly the way it's supposed to be. Things are turning out exactly the way they're supposed to be. And sometimes I don't like that. And when I'm in conflict with that, quote unquote, God's will, I'm trying to stall so we don't have to talk about sex. But when I am in conflict with those things, I'm completely out of whack. When Larry has his own ideas that aren't in alignment with what's going on in my life, I'm completely not spiritually fit, because I have different ideas of way this situation should have. It happened. I'll say this and I'll shut up. This happened recently with some work stuff. I had a whole idea of the way this situation. I work in this weird like AI space, and you know, people, ChatGPT is like all we're talking about in that world. And I'm trying to steer away from that kind of stuff. And I got really fearful of my position because of all these changes that are coming based on AI. And that fear drove me directly to start treating people poorly at my job. And I'm known as the guy who's like very laid back, very chill. Like, Larry, man, you can bring him anything. He doesn't get upset. And I started to catch myself get upset. And I turned directly to what happens here, or to what we do here, is this inventory. I inventoried it out. If you have not taken a fourth step, if you've never done an inventory, at least for me, this process starts to become second nature. When I start to get a little irritable and restless, instead of immediately, well, not immediately, sometimes it takes some time, if I'm being truthful, but at some point, I start to look internally for what's out of whack. I might initially look at you and say, what are you doing? What are these people doing to me? I work with a bunch of idiots. But at some point, I start to realize, okay, Larry, what's going on with you? Why is this getting you so irritable? Maybe I'll have to sit down with pen and paper and write it out. But this becomes a lifelong process for me. And it starts with this fourth step. This is something that I'm doing, and really a 10th step. But I'm learning how to do it here. I'm learning how to constantly start to focus on myself. And when we think about those four columns, today I can really focus more on that fourth column, but I'm learning how to do it in the very beginning. And today I can tie it directly to my fears and my defects of character. Anyways, that's all I got for that. Thanks.
Thanks. Okay. So I had a little bit of time and life did not go my way. And a lot of time when you hear in the rooms about people who have relapsed, they say that it happened before you ended up picking up the drink. And that happened to me. I thought everything was good. I thought I had it. You know, I was going to meetings. I had changed location. I had gotten a sponsor. I was meeting with that sponsor, and I was good, but I had some reservations looking back now, like hindsight being 2020. And I didn't quite know how things were really going in my life at the time. And some big things happened, and I got drunk, really drunk for like 7 months. And I remember coming out of that. And I remember being with the people in Fraser, Tennessee, and being around that table. And so it's one of the last smoking meetings, inside smoking meetings, probably in the country. Still to this day, it is a smoking meeting. And sitting around drinking coffee with these really old timers. And, you know, and they're telling me about myself. lovingly telling me about myself and talking about trust and reliance and a higher power. And they're talking to me about, you know, God doesn't want to see me this way. I can remember those conversations, because I would show up to the meetings just a complete mess, dry, trying to get sober again, starting to work steps again, but just an absolute wreck. And I remember coming out of that, and the part where it says being able to match calamity with serenity. And never in my life did I think that I would be able to handle tough situations sober without a drink. And today I can, you know, today I can handle very difficult situations and not pick up a drink and not have that be the first thought. Like, I don't have to talk myself out of a drink because I don't think about picking up a bottle for that ease and comfort. And it's because I have learned a way to assess that, those kinds of situations. You know, I find my part in things that I never thought that I would find a part in. And that's crazy to me that, like, there are messed up situations that, like, you know, it talks in the book about how, you know, like, basically, how did you get yourself here? Kind of a deal. Like, don't you kind of get yourself into these situations sometimes? And I do, you know, I put myself in the position to be hurt sometimes. And through these processes, like through an inventory process, I can see that, and I can accept, and Larry was talking about acceptance, I can accept my role, and I can just do the next thing. And to me, that's faith. I don't know. That's when I start to think about the faith that I have today, is being able to just do the next thing and to trust that I am supposed to be doing that next thing. And that is where I am supposed to be, trying to be where my feet are, just doing the next right thing. And to say that, you know, we don't apologize for God, not apologizing for this belief that, you know, there is something out there in the world that is bigger than me. Dear God, there has to be something out there in the world that is bigger than me, because I cannot run the show. I will run it into the ground. I will run it into the ground every single time. And for as many people as I hurt and will drag down with me, I will hurt myself the most. I really will. I will really hurt myself the most, you know, with alcohol or without alcohol. And that's the thing, is like, today, as a participant in my life without alcohol, I can hurt myself something fierce, and that sucks. And I don't want to do that to myself. So I do this instead. And I do have a higher power that I can depend on. You know, so when I think about fear and I think about, and I didn't say it before, but like, you know, I don't know if other people did this, like wrote down little fears as well as big fears, things like, you know, spiders, which I'm not afraid of spiders. I did not write that down on my list, but, you know, writing down little fears along with big fears. You know, sometimes I think it helps to look at those things like in relation to one another. And I know that I do that when I try to write these things down. Because if I'm not going to sweat the small stuff, you know, I have a few more minutes to look at the bigger stuff. So I hope that made some sense. That's all I got.
Thank you both. The next reading is on page 68. Now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there. But above all, we try to be sensible on this question. It is so easy to get way off track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes, perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, or it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? Larry.
So like we left off at the important point. Okay. So my sponsor had me read pages 62 to 68, and we stopped at this point. And I always, you know, at the time I was very confused because of course I'm going to read ahead. I go and read ahead. And I think it was because I misunderstood this part. I thought I was going to have to list off every sexual encounter I ever had in my life, and I was going to have to dig into that. And as we sat and talked about it, that's really not what I was trying to do here. And the next paragraph is really going to get into the meat of what I want to do when I'm writing down this sex inventory. And I'm trying not to skip ahead. So I'll try to talk about specifically what this I laugh a little bit, because I'm thinking about the author of this paragraph, and I can think about my own history in regards to sex and the way I utilize sex to hurt people or to arouse suspicion. And of course, I want to say something like, hey, let's not judge anybody. I'm one of those people where I have done things in regards to sex that have been very hurtful, have caused pain, have caused suspicion, have been harmful, right? And I do in many ways, at the time when I was doing this inventory, matter of fact, you know how there's, and I don't know if everybody has it, but my experience is most people have like a handful of things that they're going to take to the grave. I don't know why Siri's listening to me. It's good that you don't understand that. But there's always the a few things that, you know, that were taken to the grave. One of those things was regarding sex in my inventory. There was one thing that I was not going to tell him, going to take to the grave. And here I have to make this decision. Do I really want to tell this man about it? And I think what helped me, and I know we're not talking about the entirety of step four, but I think what helped me is before we started off my fifth step, it's one of those things that I wrote down, but I wasn't sure I was going to say. He shared with me his thing he was taking to do, and it was about sex. I was like, man, I think I'm actually going to tell him this. I get emotional because it was something that I had carried around for so long, and to have it lifted off of me, just to speak it in existence, it was a spiritual experience. I said it. I actually told somebody, and I just, you know, it talks about this big in Big Bill's experience of the spiritual experience, how, you know, he felt it rushing through him. That's what happened to me. It was a spiritual experience. I was able to tell another human being this thing. Now I understand at the time, the funny part about it is that the sex inventory had nothing to do with what I was talking about because I misunderstood it. That's okay though, but that's where this part came out for me. The next reading, I'll get into more depth about why I misunderstood it. But at this part of this reading, the important thing for me is my sponsor told me straight up, I'm not here to judge your sex life. If you don't have a problem with it, neither do I. We're here to talk about the things that are blocking you off from the sunlight of the spirit, your higher power. And if these things bring you pain and shame, then maybe we should talk about it. If you've harmed people, then maybe we should talk about it. Otherwise, I don't care what you've done. I'll stop there.
Yeah, I really don't have much to add to that. I mean, it says it right there. We don't want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. That's not why we're here. It's not. And so like when I've worked with people in talking about, you know, this part of the inventory and going forward, I emphasize the part that says we all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. We're here to get down to business. It says it right there. What can we do about them? How do we handle this? If there is something that is on your mind, if there is something that is on your heart that we need to talk about, we can talk about it. Like as a sponsor, and I try to do what people have done for me, like making space to talk about these things, because I know for me, in my experience, I used sex and I allowed myself to be used. I got what I wanted through sex. And that was just a fact. And there's a lot of guilt and a lot of shame associated with that for a lot of people. And, you know, so it's not just like the straight pepper diet and how people feel about it and what they want to do and how they want to do it and stuff like that. It's not that. It's just, is there something that we need to talk about it? And, you know, how can we help you move forward through this? And that's it.
Thank you both. The next one on page 69, we reviewed our own conduct over the years past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. In this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? We asked God to mold our ideals and help us live up to them. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed.
So I'm logged in on Zoom. I try to be careful because my wife is also in the rooms and I don't want to tell her story. But a lot of this part involves my wife. I've been married for 23 years. Almost 23 years. Wow. Said that out loud. When I first started going to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was the end of 2014. My wife left me in 2015. She started seeing somebody else. I started seeing somebody else. We eventually got back together and I started seriously going to AA at the end of 2015. I did not get sober, as I said earlier, until 2017. In that time period, though, I carried around for years a lot of resentment towards my wife in regards to what happened when we were separated. Not really concerned about my own behavior, more concerned about her. The fact of the matter is that during that time period we were separated, I used, and this is during my marriage, before my marriage, but particularly when we were separated, I used a lot of women to in my mind at the time, thinking that I was trying to get over my wife, trying to get back at my wife, trying to show her what she missed out on. So I used a lot of people. I used a lot of people for ease and comfort. And I harmed a lot of those women. And this is similar behavior that I did before I met my wife. And there's some transgressions there during my marriage, right? This is the part where my sponsor and he explained to me, this is not a hit list. We're not here to write down every person you've ever had sex with. What we are here to do is to look at the ways you, as Bill puts it, your sexual powers, I think is what he calls it. Never thought of it that way, but sure, if you want to call it that, great. And I had a lot of people up there that I had harmed. What I conflated with this part, though, is I thought, you know, I had some stuff happen as a child, sexual related, and I thought that's where this part belonged. But that's really, he explained to me, that's not really what we're getting into at this portion. Here, I'm looking at the way I use sex to hurt others. Very similar to my other inventory. You know, I'm looking at the way that I used people. There's one person in particular who I've never, it's sort of complicated, that I did not get to make amends to. You know, a lot of the people in the sex inventory, my sponsor and I, after talking about it, there's a lot of women up here who was like, you probably should just leave them alone. It's going to cause you more, it's going to cause your marriage more problems today if you go to these women. I have recently been given permission to go back to some of these women by my wife and make amends if I need to. So that's something that, you know, I need to think about. But this really for me was it talks about shaping my ideal sex life. Some people could say relationship life. There's been infidelity in my marriage. I have, especially when my wife and I were separated, there was a lot of really things that I'm not proud of that took place during that time period. And I think this was the beginning for me to really put that stuff down on paper. A lot of these things I didn't even want to look at. I thought they made me look pretty reprehensible, pretty disgusting. I have been able to make amends to my wife for most of those things. And like I said, I'm still, my wife has given, there was a time where part of my amends to my wife is I'd never talk to these women again. That has now changed, where she has said something different, where for my own spiritual growth, which I think is beautiful about this program. I think part of the thing is her also being in the rooms, is that through her own recovery, she's now been open for me to do things and make strides. I'm trying to talk around it, but maybe I just shouldn't. But this part, I had a lot to do here. And it was very scary. I do laugh that it's on page 69. I do find that funny. I am 12 years old. But it wasn't what I made it out to be, but I think it was important because as an alcoholic, sex and alcohol were very intertwined. It was a very problematic thing for me throughout my entire life, whether it be as a young man or as things that I did to others that I'm not proud of, or the situations that I put my wife in, and the way I use sex to harm others. This is something that I wrote thoroughly about. Anyways, that's all I can for that.
Very selfish, very dishonest, very, very inconsiderate. There was a lot. I actually, vast majority of what I talked about with regard to my sex inventory, I had to revisit it a couple of times because I kept like forgetting things, and then they would like come back to me later and I would have questions, and it was always like, leave her alone, leave him alone, do not do that. Like, you don't need to revisit these situations. The best amends that you can make in that situation is to probably never contact those people ever again, because I did not care if that was your wife, I did not care if that was your husband, it did not matter to me. You know, those were a lot of the kinds of situations that I ended up in when I was drinking, especially at the end of my drinking. I was not a very nice person when it came to sex. Sex was used against me, and so I used sex against other people. What should we have done instead? That sort of makes me chuckle internally a little bit, because, you know, the answer is just, you probably shouldn't have done that. I probably shouldn't have done those things. And in trying to shape, because that's the goal. The goal is, what do we do differently today? What am I going to do differently today? Well, I'm not going to do those things anymore. I'm not going to cheat in my marriage. I got married in 2015. I I have not cheated on my wife. This is the first relationship in my entire life where I have not cheated on the person that I was in a relationship with. And I've been in a pretty big number of relationships, throughout my life. And that's not to say that everything is perfect or anything by any stretch of the mean. But that's a living amends. I mean, it is an amends because actually the first time that I dated my wife was, we're going on like nine, it was like 19 years ago. And I did cheat on her then. And that was part of what caused the relationship to end. The other part was I threw a bag of something at her, and then she threw it out the window into the snow, and then I punched her and went after it. And that was not good. And I also do not do that in my relationships anymore. So it's an amends to not behave in that way anymore. And there are people in my life to this day that have been friends, that were friends of mine, like when I was a drinking person who I used. And I have had the opportunity to say to those people, you know, that was wrong, like what I did was wrong. And, you know, for a lot of those people, the amends, you know, they were accepted with like, well, you know, we were young or we were stupid or it was this or it was that, you know, and they didn't really think of it like that. They didn't really think of it like, oh, it was a bad thing or, oh, it, you know, but it was, and that was something that was necessary for me. It was necessary for me to own up to my part in something that I did that was wrong. And so in going through life and what I want my relationships to look like going forward, it says it's not to be used lightly or selfishly or despised and loathed. You know, it's not good or bad. In looking at how I want my relationships to be going forward, I want them to be good. I want them to not be selfish. I don't want to be a selfish person in relationships going forward. And when I work with people and they are talking to me about how they want their relationships to look going forward, we write it down. We write it down and then we put relationships to the test. Whatever kind of relationship it is, we put it to the test. But here's the fun part when we're doing these things, like a lot of people will talk to their sponsors about these kinds of things. And it's like a checklist or whatever. Well, this doesn't match and this doesn't match. So, well, what does that mean or whatever? And I don't know. I've heard people like in really early sobriety that are going through these kinds of things. And it's like, well, I'm not talking to my sponsor about that because they're going to tell me no. And that kind of thing, like that they're going to tell me that this isn't right. And that's not what I want. And that sort of thing. So I'm just not going to do it. I chuckle at that, but it goes back to like, we're not here to judge. I'm not here to judge. I'm not here to tell you like, you know, who you're supposed to see and what it's really supposed to look like and that sort of thing. Like you still get to make your own decisions. Like we're still fully adults in here that get to do our own thing and put things to the test going forward. So, I think that's all I got.
All right. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read these last two readings real quick at once. And then each of y'all will have like about 2 minutes.
Can do it.
Perfect. All right. Also on page 69, whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we have done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. We realize that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice. And the last one on page 70. To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for the strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean hard. In this book, you will read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. If you have already made a decision and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you have made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. Very
okay. 2 minutes. Okay. I know. Sorry. I giggled.
Sorry.
I'll very quickly I'll wrap it up about this. I wrote it all down. Luckily, my sponsor is not a marriage counselor. He made that very clear to me. He's not here to tell me how to manage my marriage. If anything, I knew way more about it. Been married a long time. I do go to couples counseling still to this day. I do other things outside of AA for my marriage. And I do believe I have a healthy sexual relationship today, a healthy ideal about my sex life. A big part of what came out in this inventory is the way I use sex for ease and comfort, and the way I harmed people in doing that, especially my wife. So part of my amends in regards to that is that I try not to do the whole, you know, guilt tripping and make her feel bad when I don't get my way. That has been a learning experience for me, but that's where I am today, is that has been a shift in my own behavior. This fourth step, I'll try to be, this last part, like, yeah, what it says. All I'm doing here, I know we make a big deal about it, but I'm just taking inventory of things as if I owned a business. And if I have a large inventory, it's hard for me to do it in my brain. I need to walk out there, pick up the item on the shelf, write it down, put it back. Okay, this is spoiled, et cetera, and so on. It helps me to write it down versus trying to think in my head, okay, this person, that person. So that's all I'm doing here. This is not an effort to beat myself up. This is not a process of where I'm trying to dredge up all this bad stuff to make myself feel bad. I'm just trying to really discover it so I can later on ask for help from God to remove these things. Anyways, that's all.
In thinking about this part earlier today when I was reading this, it kind of sums it up for me when it says, if sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. I am not trying to create more amends to make. That's the biggest thing for me in my sober life. I do not want to have to try hard in my life to not do more things that are going to like hurt you. It just gets to be too much to think about. So I'm not going to do those things anymore. I'm not, when it comes to working with other people and talking about those kinds of things, I am not the sponsor that is going to say to a sponsee, and I do hear this done in the rooms. I'm not the sponsor that's going to say to the sponsee, lay off the boys, lay off the girls. You don't need to do that right now. I'm not going to direct somebody how they're going to handle their life like that. In conversation, I might point out some things, that maybe there could be some things that are causing some issues that they're not, thinking about. But I am not going to be the kind of person that tells somebody what to do. This specifically says that I don't really get to do that. That's what the steps are for. That's what the literature is for. That's what the inventory is for. Working with other people as a sponsor, I just get to take somebody through it. It says God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with other persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. That sort of is what it is right there. And then the last part that that you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. I do remember what that was like after the fear and the sex inventory. I remember what that felt like, you know, and just remembering the feeling of relief, like after talking about all of the fear and kind of realizing that, that there was a place for it now, like that there were steps that I could take in order to, you know, be able to look at all of these things and to let them go. It's like kind of, I mean, it is, it's the first step to like learning how to let this stuff go. You know, so it's not sitting with me and literally killing me anymore. So that's all I got.
Thank you both. All right. Let's clap for this wonderful. That was awesome, y'all. Thank you so much. All right. We're going to pass the seventh tradition basket. The seventh tradition states that every AA group fully self-supporting declining out while each group's rent and other expenses, while contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup area and service office are supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety, our group endeavors to provide a space for all attendees and encourage and here to concur in welcoming in which our meeting announcements. Are there any?
Larry, alcoholic.
Larry.
Joys of Recovery is celebrating their anniversary this Thursday. That's pretty much all I know about it. I'm certain they're having food. The meeting normally starts at 8 o'clock on Thursday. It's on the Taiwan Alliance Group website, the meeting, Joys of Recovery Thursday in Chesapeake.
Thank you.
This group has got an event coming up in June. It's too early to announce it, so I'm not announcing it. But there's flyers on the table over there in a sort of a sky blue. And if you wouldn't mind taking a few of them out with you, take them back to your groups, that'd be awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Amy. I'm an alcoholic. And Visky Paw is hosting a pajama party at Evo House. It is Saturday, April 15th to 16th at 2010 Old Richmond Road West in Toano. And there's a flyer online. I can tell you more about it if you're interested after the meeting.
Thank you. Right. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or are in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands.
Woo.
All right. Point out that literature is available. Literature is available right there on that table. Please see me or any home group member after the meeting if you would like to buy a book. If you can fold it, it's free. Sponsorship question. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available right here after the meeting. Please feel free to talk to any of us. If you're shy, you can always send an email to info@simpleactions.net. Reminders, smokers, please use the butt cam provided outside and stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. Meeting after the meeting. All are invited and encouraged to join us for fellowship at the meeting after the meeting that will be held at Cafe Stella on Colonial Avenue, like six blocks that way on your left-hand side next door to Kogan's Pizza.
Stella.
All right. In closing, let's everybody thank the panel again. All right. And Travis has been voluntold two paragraphs.
See to it that in great events will commit your faults to him. Clear away the record. Surely.
Thank you. We have a nice way of closing. Let's circle up.
Yep.
That's
nice.
Our Father.
Who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and glory, forever and ever.
Come back and work for you. Work.
I just turned them down.